Hello, everyone, and welcome to High Performance Pathways. I'm your host, Court Whitman. Today's show, sponsored by Big Sky Bravery. Big Sky Bravery provides high adrenaline recreational programming to active duty special operations forces as a means to improve their psychological and emotional well-being. Hey, if you're interested, learn more about Big Sky Bravery at bigskybravery.org. And if you really want to make a difference, if you've been following my show for a while, you'll know this is a new sponsor for us. But, you know, you can make a difference right now. Take 5 minutes of your time, write a letter, send it to Big Sky Bravery, attention Josh McCain at 215 Quail Run, Unit A, Bozeman, Montana, 95718. And in your letter, express some sort of gratitude or thanksgiving to America's Special Operation Forces. Because what I can tell you is Josh will hand deliver that to an active duty Special Operations warrior while they're on retreat there with him on a 5-day experience. And it will definitely have an impact on their well-being and allow them to return to the fight for you, for each other, and for this great country. So, hey, if you're moved to do that, I encourage you to. Josh will be stoked to hear from you. For all new listeners out there, what is High Performance Pathways, right? Well, let me tell you real quick. It's a purpose-built and specially selected collection of someone's experience. In this case, my friend Dave Leach, as he comes on the show and discusses how he has understood, discovered, and just been chasing high performance in his own life. You see, I collect this content during a one-on-one interview, and then we share it with you. Why? Because I believe everyone has a different path to high performance. And hearing about the path that other professionals have journeyed along, it's informative and it inspires us. So, during each episode of High Performance Pathways, it's my intent to do 5 things for you, the listener. Number one, connect. Connect you to someone else to build out your professional relationships. Number two, I'm going to ask questions so that together we can understand Dave's experience. Number three, I'm going to share my thoughts as I listen to Dave in this conversation to help raise maybe a different perspective. Number four, I'm going to teach to increase confidence. And number five, together with my guest, my number one goal is to inspire you as a listener in some way to have some sort of a growth experience in this moment. One additional note to cover as you continue listening to the show, everybody, this is raw content, meaning there's absolutely no post-production editing we do here in High Performance Pathways. We record live, and we deliver that recording to you exactly as it was recorded. So, hey, let's get to it. As I know you're excited, I am too. But before we do, let me give a little bit of background on this incredible human being, friend, colleague, brother-in-arms of mine, Dave Leach. So here we go. Dave's a 32-year Army veteran. He began his career serving others with an enlistment into the Army at age 17, y'all. And then Dave went on and ascended to positions of increased responsibility over 3 decades of service to our incredible nation, culminating as a colonel. And so folks that aren't in the military kind of domain like me, you see the movies, you see the big eagle, the silver eagle, the bird on the uniform. My man Dave wore that on his chest and on his hat and on other places. And it's a big deal, right? It's the one right before the general star, y'all, just to give you some insight. And his final assignment in the Army was with the Joint Special Operations Command here at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That's right, y'all. My home base is in North Carolina. See, Dave retired in 2018, and he currently lives at Jacksonville Beach, Florida. And he serves now as Vice President of Learning and Leader Development at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. And Dave also is the chief operating officer for a national nonprofit called Wear Blue, Run to Remember. More importantly, Dave and his wife Shannon will celebrate 25 years of marriage together this year, and they have 3 incredible children. Austin, who's 23, who Dave and Shannon are excited to share with you, is a senior at the University of South Florida. Ryan, 21. Senior at the United States Military Academy, will soon be serving in our great military. And Megan, who's 20, is a rising junior at the University of Colorado Boulder. Folks, Dave and I met about 3 years ago. I want to provide a little bit of context here into our relationship. And really, when Dave was still in the Army and serving at Joint Special Operations Command at Fort Bragg, but really beginning to focus on his transition out and his exit strategy, and his first kind of step into the private sector. And in just some small way, I was able to just offer Dave a little bit of insight, a little bit of exposure to the private sector. And I hosted him at the company Teamworks that I served at, software company there in Durham, North Carolina at the time, and just kind of exposed him to what this company did and how we serve. And we've stayed in touch ever since. So I'm thrilled to have Dave on the show today. I have, you know, a strong belief that his experience and his perspective will deeply resonate within the listening base. And so Dave, man, just thanks for being here to talk about your experience, your passion for leadership and leader development, you know, kind of your road out of the Army, your service in this incredible nonprofit, and just your overall commitment that I understand of just chasing high performance in your life. Thanks for being here, buddy.
Hey, thanks a lot, Cort. I really appreciate that. I'm humbled and fired up to be here as part of your ongoing discussion on achieving high performance. I just want to thank you, you know, for that initial meeting we had. I mean, you were so gracious in having me up to Durham and the Teamworks and explaining to me about the process of transition, all the you know, the things that you had gone through and the impact that it had on you and your life. And you continued to stay involved and in touch with me, which helped as I made the move to corporate America. So thanks again. Thanks for that. And I'm real excited to be here as part of the conversation.
Yeah, man. Nobody else we'd rather spend our time with today than you, my friend. So as we settle in together, let's talk about kind of your early developmental journey, right? And I always like to ask guests that come on here about what it was like growing up. So I think our growing up experience is developmental. So how about you, man? And any thoughts you'd share or insights maybe to kind of set the foothold here for this conversation? What was it like growing up for you? And did you have any mentors or role models or people you kind of look to for guidance early in life?
Yeah, great question. I'd say I had a pretty typical upbringing. I did grow up in a very rural coal mining town in Southwest Virginia, down near the Tennessee-Kentucky border on that side of the state of Virginia. I played sports in high school, but wasn't good by any means. And I really was not a great student. I didn't have the discipline nor the foresight to understand the importance of education. But I was fortunate to have a group of teachers who saw more in me and expected more of me than I displayed. And their influence clearly guided me in my early years. And really, now looking back on that, I could see the value of their engaged personal leadership and the impact that it had, because they expected more of me and pushed me to do more for myself.
Awesome. I always love kind of this idea of people have expectations for me. I think it's hard sometimes. Like I even look about leading in my own family, and just this morning I wake up to a bonus room. We had a cousin of ours spend the night last night, and I got a bonus room of half eaten strawberries, half a loaf of bread, Gatorade bottles, and just stuff everywhere, man. It's like a starburst. And in that moment, I'm trying to say, did I properly frame expectations from my kids on what last night and this morning looked like? And so, you know, the thing I want to bring up here in this moment, since you offered up this idea of expectations, is expectations are powerful. And so for anybody to listen right now, you know, how can you move away from like a dynamic of rule creation and maybe just, you know, more gently talk through, you know, what you expect and expectations, and then allow people to kind of work through and exist in that. It's something I'm trying to do better at, because I'm typically a rules guy, at least when it comes to the home with kids. But I think expectations are powerful. And certainly, as you recall right here, there were people around you, adults in this case, teachers maybe, that expected more. And in some cases, maybe that led you to the Army. I don't know. Maybe it was the fact that just not a great student, because we all know there's tons of folks that make the way to the Army. But I'm just curious for you, Dave, what inspired you really to make that decision at 17 to join the Army and then stay for so long, man, 30 years plus service? What inspired you?
Yeah, that's those are two kind of separate questions here, because I'll tell you that the reason I joined the Army was a little different from the reason why I stayed. So I joined the Army. Again, I was not a great student. My parents were not college graduates. So college was not a viable option. I mean, it was never discussed in my home about going to college. Mm-hmm. I knew I didn't want to work in the coal mines, which was the predominant industry in our area. And my father was an Air Force veteran. He'd spent some time in the Air Force, but
really?
it wasn't why I was, he was my stepfather. It wasn't why I was growing up with him. So it wasn't that big of an influence in terms of, I saw the kind of lifestyle. I just, you know, had heard his stories about, you know, the benefits of service. So there was a little bit of influence. There was a little discussion of the military as an option. What it did appeal to me was the challenge of the military and pushing myself. And I recognized that even though it didn't manifest in academic work or athletic work, I did feel this drive to be pushed, to want to be challenged and pushed. Mm-hmm. So I joined the military, 17 years old, right out of high school. I left 2 months after I graduated. I was still 17, finished my advanced training as a helicopter mechanic before I turned 18, and made my way to Fort Bragg to my first duty assignment. Now, what inspired me to stay over the rest of the time, and Cord, this is going to highlight just how short-sighted I was at 20 years old. So I was in the military at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and my supervisors had encouraged me to start attending college at night, which, you know, again, a powerful demonstration of engaged personal leadership. They pushed me to go to school. So I said, I'm going to go to college. So I started attending school at night. And one evening I'm on break. I see a brochure for the Army's ROTC scholarship program. As I'm reading through this, it explains how the Army has a program to release service members from the military to go to college full time to get their degree and their commission as an officer. And as this, a light bulb went over my head. I'm going to get out of the Army by getting an ROTC scholarship. That's what I thought was going to happen. I'm going to get out of the Army at 20 years old and go to college full time. But, oh, yeah, I'm going to do it with this ROTC scholarship program. Well, the plan worked brilliantly. It only took 30 years for it to happen, though. I did get out of the Army 30 years later, but after I'd spent my career there. So I joined for the challenge. I stayed because each assignment, I gained a greater appreciation for the selfless nature of service, mm-hmm. the satisfaction with working with absolutely incredible people from all over our country, and the excitement and opportunity that the missions in each unit offered. So it was a transition throughout my life that grew as I continued to serve.
It's awesome, man. I think that in my own reflection on my service, I absolutely feel like there were times that I said, hey, is it time to go? Is it time to stay? And it just continued to, the answer was time to stay, not as long as you did, my friend. But thank you so much for kind of sharing what kind of that initial inspiration was, and then how that decision, in my opinion, was quite life-changing, because it was a three-decade experience of service in uniform to others. And to be honest, man, you've traveled all over the world. Right. And let me just name some locations here for the mm-hmm. listener where Dave has served. Obviously, North Carolina, that's where Fort Bragg is, Alabama, Germany, Turkey, Iraq, Wyoming, Tennessee, Belgium, and Afghanistan. And I've probably missed some stops in between the way. Right. There's probably been some training. There's probably been some temporary duty. Right. But yep. those are kind of the ones that jumped out to me, partner, from, you know, the bio that you shared with me. And I'm just curious, man. Do you have any memorable moments, or maybe your top memorable moment or two, or assignment of your time in service? And I know 30 years is, good gracious, it's a big gulp, buddy. But is there anything that jumps out in this moment by way of memories?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't spend that much time in a career field and not be just inundated with incredible memories. And you know, I just consider myself so blessed to have had such a phenomenal career. You know, as an aviation officer, I obviously did some aviation assignments that were incredible, but I also had some broadening assignments that were just as rewarding and informative for me. So I'll just super quick run through some of the more impactful moments. First and foremost, I had a 3-year assignment to Belgium, and it was such a unique assignment, flying for the Supreme Allied Commander. That position started in World War II with General Eisenhower, and continues to this day with an American 4-star general serving as a Supreme Allied Commander. And I was in charge of, I was in command of the detachment, the 2-helicopter detachment that provided support for him. And we literally, I've literally landed a Black Hawk helicopter in downtown Paris, downtown London. I've landed it at the National Cemetery in Normandy for the 65th D-Day anniversary. I mean, it was an incredible flying assignment and very rewarding from that aspect. Personally, our family was had the opportunity to travel all throughout Europe, which really opened my kids' eyes to the greater world around them, and that education is invaluable. Secondly, in a broadening assignment, I was assigned for a year at the University of Tennessee as the head of the ROTC department. And in this capacity, I was the Army on campus, right? So everything we did really projected the image of the Army for the staff. We did leader development activities with the athletic department, and we were able to highlight the quality of individuals that choose to pursue a life in the military through these engagements. Of course, the very best thing about the assignment was instructing the senior class of cadets as they finished their program and went on their way to become lieutenants. It was richly rewarding watching their leadership growth. And I stay in touch with many of those cadets now who are just this past week, I got an invite to one of their promotions to major. So, you know, they're at the midpoint in their career. But if I had to choose one, I'd definitely say that my time at Fort Bragg ranks at the top. And I spent multiple rotations at Fort Bragg in North Carolina as a barely 18-year-old young man. The 82nd Airborne was a great place to start my career. And Court, I tell you, it wasn't natural. I'm terrified of heights. And I arrived at Fort Bragg, not assigned to the 82nd, but through a friend of mine who was in the 82nd, I said, I'm going to volunteer and go to that organization. So I had to volunteer to go to jump school, head down to Benning and go to airborne school and then come back to Bragg and to my assignment in the 82nd. So it wasn't a natural, you know, migration to the 82nd, but I love being a paratrooper. I love the history of the organization and the culture. I ended up being a company commander, a battalion and brigade XO, a battalion commander, and served at JSOC all while at Fort Bragg. Two of my three kids were born at Fort Bragg. I went to college in Fayetteville, right there outside of Fort Bragg. And I'm convinced I would not have had the career that I had or the experience had it not been for my very first assignment, you know, in an airborne organization in North Carolina.
Yeah, man, I just love it. I wish you could see me right now. I'm just smiling, right? I don't have the best smile, but I'm just moved to smile because I listened to you. And my first assignment, which was the 82nd Airborne Division too, a couple years older than you, I was 22. But I'll tell you, there's not a better place to start. I mean, I learned so much about what it was to just be a professional from the organization. And so shout out to the incredible 82nd Airborne Division and just the lineage of leaders that organization has had an impact on. And I don't care who's listening and what you think, there's something to jumping out of an airplane that also helps you kind of work your way through, you know, stuff like perseverance, grit, you know, kind of crisis, fear, all those things that help feed us as we move forward in life. So Dave, thanks so much for your reflection. And I love this title. Is it Supreme Allied Commander? Did I get that right?
Yeah. I mean, isn't that fantastic? The Supreme Allied Commander.
It sounds like Spielberg, you know, was out there in Belgium with you as he developed the different names he used in Star Wars, man. It's just incredible. But man, I'm super jealous of the stuff that you did just by your 2-minute sharing of what occurred there in that 3-year tour in Europe. Our country's so much a baby compared to others in this great world. And hey, if you're thinking about the Army, here's your chance. Your career might look like Dave's. It's incredible, y'all. So just encouraging anyone listening that's considering service in the military, from me, do it. And from Dave, I think he'd say the same thing because he did it for 30 years. I want to talk about in this moment, man, as we continue together about, you know, a time that in my opinion, and I don't know it, I didn't live this, that was probably significantly emotionally distressing for you. And with your permission, I would love for maybe you just to set us straight and tell your portion of the story here. But you did share with me that when you were in assignment to Turkey, flying humanitarian assistance missions in northern Iraq in support of what we call Operation Provide Comfort, that there was a friendly fire incident and some loss to life within your command. Could you share, Dave, just and recall maybe this experience? You know, what was your role? What actions did you take, if any, and any lessons that you learned, and how this experience has had an impact on your development as a future leader and manager, if any?
Yeah, absolutely, Cord. Thanks. So, just for the listeners, this happened back in 1994. So, I mean, that's quite a while ago for some of you. But it was in my first assignment as an aviation officer. I literally shown up to Germany in January of 94, and was very excited to learn that our unit was providing helicopter support for the mission in Turkey and northern Iraq, Operation Provide Comfort. And that mission was to twofold. Number one, to enforce the no-fly zone over northern Iraq after the first Gulf War. And number two, to support a small special forces ground team in Zaku, Iraq, as they patrolled and enforced the security zone, a smaller portion of the no-fly zone. So we would take personnel and supplies from our base in Turkey, fly it into northern Iraq, pick up the team, the Military Coordination Center team, and fly them on aerial patrols throughout the security zone in northern Iraq. On one morning, on a routine patrol, unfortunately, two Air Force F-15s misidentified our two helicopters flying in formation as Iraqi Hinds, and they shot them down, killed all 26 people on board, to include our coalition partners from France, Great Britain, Turkey, and then the Kurdish guards that were accompanying us on our patrol as well. It was just a terrible, terrible incident. I was a platoon leader, brand new. This happened in April of 94. I just arrived in January, so I had barely been there 4 months. I was sitting in our operations office in our hangar in Germany, and the phone rang, and I picked it up. It was a spouse of one of the deployed crew members. And now, mind you, at this point, we're not too far removed from the Gulf War, but we're absolutely not in the deployment cycle that, you know, our military is used to for the last 20 years here. So being deployed was a big thing. So the spouse calls and says, "Hey, I just heard on the radio that there was a helicopter shot down in Iraq. And at the time it was being reported as an Iraqi helicopter. What can you tell us about that?" And we had no information. I mean, literally that was the first we'd heard of it. And, we took her in it had broken really? On AFN.
Have we not come a long way? Have we not come a long way in what we know and our ability to battle track? So what I'm hearing is the news was broke to you by a spouse calling in to maybe the op center, wherever you were in this hangar. Man, please continue.
Yeah, so that first call, the next call is our commander is getting summoned to our battalion headquarters, which is just a street away from our hangar. He moves to the battalion headquarters. Then the next phone call is another spouse. And then another spouse and another spouse, and they're growing increasingly more worried. And then the news finally breaks that it was our two aircraft, and that we lost the crew. Over the next few days, my platoon and I, we departed to replace the downed air crews. And my first flight in Turkey was to return the remains of the Kurdish guards back to Zaku, because they'd taken all the remains to the base in Turkey and to sort them out. And then we returned them back to their home in Iraq. It was unimaginable, Court. You can imagine just how our thought process. How could anybody misidentify our aircraft painted with U.S. flags? I mean, they had a unique paint scheme as Iraqi. The incident absolutely shaped my thinking as an aviator and as an officer for the rest of my career. And I'll just super quick run through a couple of those lessons. Number one, actions have consequences. I know that's not a brilliant observation, but it's absolutely true. And I never forgot that as a pilot, that I have people in the back of my aircraft and my actions have consequences. In this case, it was a matter of life and death, but it matters in daily business in our lives that our actions have consequences. Number two, attention to detail, that small things matter. You know, fixing what, as a leader, what small area, what small discrepancy might I fix or adjust or notice that could break the chain of events that could potentially lead to a catastrophic failure down the road. And that could have been, you know, in this case, again, life or death, but what about now in my life as a parent, as a coach, as a business person? What area do I need to put my focused attention on to avoid a major problem down the road? And then finally, don't take things for granted, right? There were four crews in Turkey. It was very small. It's a platoon of people. Four crews, two of which flew every day and two were off. It could have been anyone on that mission. So, you know, I just think how important it is to have your shit together daily and live with no regrets, right? I want to make sure that I'm squared away as the best of I can be and live my life with no regrets, because, you know, we're not guaranteed another day.
Yeah, man, what a great bit of sharing out in this reflection for the listener. I think some lessons learned for us all to kind of just allow to sink in. Hey, your actions have consequences. Pay attention to the details and don't take things for granted. And Dave's challenge here to you as a listener, live without regret, right? Because the next day isn't guaranteed. So thanks, Dave, for sharing that and for the opportunity to maybe inspire folks listening to include some of that to the way they're doing things within their own home, within their own business, within the workplace. Like to continue with the conversation here, my friend, with a little bit more sharing out, if I may, on your accomplishments. But you just talked about some of your service as an aviator, and I know you've done not just that, but we're talking master aviator qualification with over 2,000 flight hours. And so you flew folks for a long time, some of which weren't even American, as you just went through that story. And one day the Army reaches out and says, "Hey, Dave, check it out, man. We're sending you to Wyoming to lead a U.S. Army recruiting company." I have also served within what we call USAREC's portfolio. And it's a little, in my opinion, foreign from flying in a combat armed capacity here as an aviator and then going on to recruit men and women to come into our great Army. So I'm just curious, man, how difficult was this, if any, a transition for you in your military service? If it wasn't, then we got nothing to talk about. If it was, maybe there's something to talk about, because I am absolutely making some assumptions here. But if it was a difficult transition to step into this space, were there anything habit-wise you drew upon to excel in kind of this new and arguably foreign assignment? And what did you learn about yourself at the conclusion of this particular tour?
Yeah, great. It was indeed, Court. You know, I mean, it was a completely foreign environment going from the operational Army to this piece where you're, you know, in a completely different environment, working with individuals from different career fields and their cultures, you know, internal to the Army was different. And to compound the transition, my specific unit that I've been assigned to had not made their assigned recruiting mission in over 4 years. So there's that piece of it. And I don't want to in any way, project a negative image of recruiting, recruiting or the organization as a whole. It's just a simple matter of fact, right? I took over this organization, and that's where we were. And it was going from the 82nd Airborne Division to this environment created a little bit of a cultural, you know, certainly a cultural shift. I just remember distinctly sitting in a recruiting station and an applicant was sitting there. You know, I hadn't been around young 17, 18 year olds in a while. And the kid's sitting in a chair kind of slouched over, and I ask him a question and he just kind of slouches over and just kind of, yeah, you know, half baked answer. And I said, "Hey, why don't you stand up when somebody talks to you?" And my recruiters, they pull me aside afterwards and said, "Sir, you can't talk to the applicants that way. They're not in the Army yet." I said, "Yeah, but we can treat them like, we can treat them like we want to be, you know, we would expect, you know, young professionals to be treated, right? I mean, they're not in here to continue their lives as they are. They're in here to be like you. So treat them like, you know, to expect more, right? The expectation piece." So it was a different culture. I'll tell you, Court, for me, it was the first time in the military where you have these quantifiable, you know the deal, right? You make your mission. It's a monthly mission to get a certain number of recruits in certain categories to man the military. It's an incredibly important job. Yes. As we see now, as we're deployed, you know, the organizations need forces to work on every assignment, every job in the military. So it's critical. So I was surprised that our organization had not made their mission. You know, I just envisioned that like, hey, I failed my physical fitness test every month, or I failed to make my sales quotas if I was working in corporate America. So what I did when I took over, I immediately went to work to establish accountability. The team really had a victim mentality, blaming the marketing team, blaming the mission was too high, the sergeant major doesn't support us, nobody understands our market. There was zero individual responsibility and accountability for our mission, mine. I owned it now, and it was mine as well. So I immediately started working on that in terms of messaging and demonstrating what was expected of them. Again, back to the expectations piece of it. Number two, I worked on the basics. I repeatedly told our team, hey, in order to be a good recruiter, you simply have to be a good soldier. There's nothing magical or special about it. Know and follow the standards. Work and commit each day to do your very best, and the numbers will work out. We'll be okay. And then finally, I worked very hard at trying to help the team stay balanced. Recruiting is an incredibly tough job. At that time, they were working 6 days a week, often 12-plus hour days, dealing sometimes with a
Yeah. But you're right, David. It is so tough because, like, we got to think the access and placement they need the people to talk to happens on the weekend, right? Or mm-hmm. when kids aren't in school.
And exactly.
You know, or not at work, not to assume for a moment that everyone that enlists is at 17 like you were. Probably a high population, but yeah, I'm with you, man. The insight to what it takes to be a recruiter for this great army, It was very shocking for me. I didn't appreciate it until I was assigned to USAREC for that tour that I had. Please continue.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to finish with, you know, as you just very well stated, it was a grind. And if they didn't focus on their personal well-being, physical fitness, caring for their emotional health and their family, maintaining a healthy balance, their performance would suffer. Their performance both at work and at home would suffer. So I really focused on helping them achieve some sort of balance in their work and personal lives. And then, I ended up at the end of those 2 years so rewarded by the assignment. I enjoyed it. You know, all my peers like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're leaving aviation to go work in recruiting for 2 years. But it was such a great assignment because I was able to meet, again, incredible people that were willing to serve the military. You know, as a recruiting company commander, I had to find and recruit and enlist one person. And that person joined the military, finished their college degree and became an officer and is now serving. And this past year competed in the best Ranger competition and is serving as an officer in the military intelligence branch. And,
really?
So recruiters they change people's lives. They change people's lives. You know, some recruits, be the first kid out of their family to ever go to college or the first kid ever to leave their hometown, you know, whatever it is, they have an opportunity to change people's lives. And I really enjoyed the assignment.
Yeah, man, sounds like it. I talked to so many people that I always, you know, kind of try to figure out, hey, what's this fulfillment look like for you in your life? And it generally always comes back to my best memories of the times I felt most fulfilled in the workplace is when I'm serving others and making a difference in someone's life. And sometimes we don't know that until we have a story like this that we can share about a guy you brought into the organization that's now doing incredible things. And a lot of folks might not know what Best Ranger is, but, you know, we're talking about, you know, some of the most highly trained, best physically fit, most capable and competent infantrymen that our Army has to offer. They all come together and compete in a competition. It's not easy to do, you know, it's incredible. So you definitely having the ability to say I made an impact on someone's life and I know it because they've shared with me an update. It's powerful. And so if you're listening right now and there's someone you haven't thanked or at least updated in your life on your progress that you attribute that there's someone there that enabled you to do something, hey, let them know, y'all. Because it's helpful for them. It inspires people, right? Three people come to name right now for me. Number one, Rob Patton, who's a friend of mine that I served with in the Army years ago when I was in the 82nd Airborne Division that I continued to kind of chase. He was a logistic leader, incredible guy. He was a captain when I was a young lieutenant. Rob Lively, another great friend of mine that I was a troop sergeant major when I was his XO, and he's just a phenomenal leader that's continued to inspire and support me in the work that I do. And then a close friend of mine, Jerry Patton, who unfortunately lost his life. He was my team sergeant in Special Forces. And after we served together, he died in a free fall accident. But I wouldn't have done the things that I've done. Specifically, I wouldn't have gone to SFAS without Rob Patton. I wouldn't have gone and assessed with the Special Missions Unit without Jerry Patton. And I would not have done some of the other things that I've done in life without these people. So let people know and give them updates if they've inspired you in some way. I want to talk, brother, now about kind of your transition out of the Army and what you do now for Bank of America Merrill Lynch as Vice President of Learning and Leader Development. And really, because people consume this show that are going through a transition experience, a lot of military that are working their way into the private sector for the very first time. And I think what are we talking now, Dave? A year or two that you've been out and involved in the private sector? Am I right or wrong on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I retired August of 18 and started working for Merrill in May of 19. So I've been with the firm for just over a year now, but I've been out next week. It'll be 2 years.
Yeah, man. So it's still new, in my opinion, and probably in some cases, maybe still settling in. But could you share maybe some advice for folks that are in transition out of the military after spending so much time like you did, and maybe even a challenge or two that you had to face and move through in order to find that next great company or place in which you could continue to serve?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you, you're exactly right, Court. It still is new. I was bike riding the other morning, and it hit me that August is next week, and it will be 2 years since I retired. I still feel like it was yesterday. As a matter of fact, my wife catches me, and I'll say, "Hey, I just retired from the military." Said, "No, you didn't. It was 2 years ago." But it feels like, it's just like, "Hey, I just got back from deployment." No, that was 4 years ago. So, you know, she catches that, and but it still feels so fresh, and I recognize everybody's experience is different with it. But the fact is, you don't spend time in the military, whether it's 4 years or 30 years, and it doesn't become a little bit of who you are and what you've done, you know, and part of your life, because it demands so much of you, right? I mean, you're immersed in the life of the military. I'll tell you, I don't think I was egotistically attached to rank or position, but the fact is, just like I said, it becomes part of who you are. Sure. And learning to let go of some of that is challenging. It's challenging. Now, I'll tell you, I'd like to think that I'm not one of those, you know, nerdy ex-military guys that, can't let go and, keeps the haircut super tight and isn't letting it go. But the fact is, it's challenging, and it does impact you, and it impacts your personal self as well. If you're not careful, you can find yourself comparing your purposeful life, what you considered a purposeful existence in the military, to a little bit less purposeful existence outside of the military in the business, in business, because the focus is different, right? When I just remember distinctly being surprised at the open discussion of, you know, the value and really talking financial value that you can bring to an organization, when in the military we're more about mission focus and a little bit more philosophical idea. Secondly, if you're not careful, you'll be unable to adjust to a new environment with a different culture and a different vocabulary and focus. You got to understand that it's different. It's not bad. It's just different. And you have to be able to make that switch, right? How effectively can I navigate change in my life and understand that it's just a different environment? So to adjust to that, I think personally, I think the greatest way to overcome those potential downfalls is the ability to see yourself, to spend time before you get out, before you transition, to understand what you liked about the military, what you believe drives you, and how can you tie that into what you think you want to do. A perfect example, right? So many folks, hey, I want to do this. I want to be a defense contractor when I get out of the military. Okay, does that naturally jive with what drives you as a human being? Or is that just something I'm comfortable with and I'm familiar and I know I can get into it? I'd argue that you'll probably be very successful as a defense contractor and go on probably for a very successful career. But is that really what's going to make you, super happy and drive you and achieve your personal why? Court, you know the deal. I mean, there's so many factors that influence, hey, I need to get a job because I got to pay for my family and my bills and those things like that. And people are in different places along the journey. I totally get that. But if you're given the opportunity, and if you have the opportunity, take some time and investigate and understand yourself, see yourself so that you can make the best choice, make the best informed decision for you, your family, and your career moving forward.
I couldn't agree with you more. I never heard it said so eloquently. I just want to repeat it. From what I understand, the foundation that you established and the advice that you share with others that are going through a transition experience, and it doesn't have to be just out of the military, anybody that's going through a transition in their career or their profession, how are you assessing your ability to see yourself? Beautiful. Because there's something there that's going to inform what you run towards. And you got to do it. And we all have constraints, Dave, you're exactly right. But don't allow the constraints to overpower this inquiry into having this ability to see yourself. I would use the word self-awareness, but I like your language here even much better. So thanks for sharing that, partner.
I'm sorry, if I can just super quick interject too.
Yeah.
Just as you said, you said that there's absolutely reality constraints, right? I mean, hey, I would love to be idealistic and get this fantastic job working for X company doing what I, is my dream job. But the simple fact is I need a job and I got to pay the bills. But understanding yourself and the ability to see yourself will let you shape areas outside of, your professional life. So if I can't get the job that drives me personally and answers my why, but at least I know enough about myself that I'm going to pursue outside activities that meet that need. And then, that I can kind of make up some of that in other areas in my life. So again, I just think it's critically important to be able to see yourself.
Well said. I mean, my dream job would be a football coach. My constraint was salary. It's not going to work. Right. And so to your point, mm-hmm. So I get a job that gives me the autonomy to be able to go and volunteer as a youth football coach so I can leave the office by 5 to make practice. I'm still there because I understand what my life needs to look like to be fulfilled. Maybe that's why you serve as chief operating officer at Wear Blue, Run to Remember. Maybe that's your ability to stay in touch with the service to this great nation that maybe is underrepresented in your role as the VP for Learning and Leader Development for Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Like, I don't know, but I'm thinking, because if I look at my life and look at what you're doing, it's finding those other ways to fill the cup up, even if it's not all in the workplace. So, appreciate the sharing, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the way you drove through that for us, because I think it's really important. I do want to touch on maybe just habits. A lot of people tune into the show to get perspective specifically on, what do you do, Dave? What did you do, Dave, to become a colonel in the military? How's that maybe informed what you continue to do now in this new environment with Bank of America? And so my question for you in this moment is, are there any habits, and do you mind sharing them, that maybe had a birthplace in the Army? Because, hey, let's face it, brother, you've been in the Army since 17. We got to attribute, the Army to maybe some of these habits. But is there anything you could share that you could thank the Army for creating this a habit for you that you continue to lean into now in the private sector to perform at a high level there with Bank of America?
Yeah, absolutely. This will come to no surprise, but the first is discipline, right? So having the discipline to do what's right in every aspect. I tell my kids, hey, the future comes in daily doses, right? So if I decide not to get up and work out today, it's probably not going to hurt me today. But if I decide that every single day, then, in the future, those daily those daily failures are going to catch up to me. So having a disciplined approach to what I do, and that doesn't mean a rigid, inflexible mindset. It just means that I'm disciplined to do what I think I need to do and what I know needs to be done. Right. Secondly, is maintaining perspective, right? The ability to see the big picture and issues from all sides. And as you get a little bit older, I'm more and more understanding of the fact that I just simply don't know everything I think I know. And I strive to, maintain perspective. And I think we're seeing it, in our national conversations, right? Our inability to have a conversation where we strive to understand the other person's or other side's perspective. And I think that takes away from our ability to execute whatever to ask, whatever we're being asked to execute. So maintain perspective is critically important. And then finally, to me, you'll hear this again in another as we continue along, but I think attitude is everything. When I first started with my current role at Merrill, my manager commented during my mid-year review about my can-do and positive attitude. And I think you learn that in the military, right? I mean, no one, you don't come into work with a crappy attitude, and you certainly don't talk to your supervisor or your boss and with a crappy attitude. I think we learn very early in the military that attitude is important and that we're expected to have a positive attitude. I think it's a force multiplier. I think that, it's contagious. I think, leaders set the temperature, and if I come in with a great attitude every single day, and the chances are that organization is probably going to have one as well.
Absolutely, man. I can remember a young woman I worked with. Her name was Erin, and good gracious, what she is a contagious attitude. Even in some cases, I would argue maybe she underperformed in a couple things, but she was just a joy to be around. And so I can't agree with you more. And on the other side of the coin, again, leaning back into my experiences as a youth sport coach, kids that I'm coaching, you just want to coach the kids that show up with a can-do attitude. And there may be some that are more talented, but don't have that attitude, that are kind of frustrating. And I think that applies to the workplace too. So, the reflections here, the habits that Dave is encouraging you to consider in your role and whatever that applies to, in your life, be disciplined. Seek to understand the big picture by gaining and growing in perspective as you make decisions. And then finally, embrace one heck of a great attitude, because it matters. Thanks for sharing, brother. Want to talk about management in this moment. Talk about leadership. I talk about management a lot with folks, and even in some cases on this show. I definitely see those two terms as very different. And every chance I get to speak to someone like you who has led large numbers of people as a manager, I'm always curious, what did you practice as a manager that you kind of now know enabled you to be effective and perform at a high level in that managerial role? And if not, maybe you've been around a lot of great leaders. What have you seen from managers that you serve that would say, man, that guy or that girl is just phenomenal, and I would run through a wall for them? Because I think there's a strong desire to kind of understand some of this from your perspective, and so that folks can maybe practice it if they're not, and maybe it could be confirming if there are things that they are doing as managers out there in the workplace. So could you comment on that, Dave? Habits of high-performing managers, in your opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. And Cord, I wish I had some brilliant flashes of genius for the audience. I wish you're gonna walk away and like, oh, but that was eye opening. It was enlightening. It was something I've never heard before. But unfortunately, I'm just not that good. But I'll tell you, I think in answer to your question here, I think these are important and they're incredibly valuable in my leadership experience. You look back at all those ones that you just described and say, okay, what made that person a good leader? And I'll tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is that they're good with people. I know it's not rocket science, but people will understand if you don't know all the technical aspects of a job. They will not understand if you're a jerk, right? My son, as he's He's a rising senior at West Point, and I know he and his classmates are concerned about, you know, what, hey, I'm going to be a leader in the military, and how am I going to be a good leader? And I tell him, you know, he was down for this prolonged spring break, and his friends came to visit. And I said, guys, focus on learning how to be good with people. Work on your interpersonal skills. They can be trained. They can be learned. But I'm telling you, you don't know all the technical details of what you're about to be involved in, but you can learn how to be good with people. And I think that's important. Secondly, have a great attitude. We just discussed it above, but one of my favorite authors and my favorite quotes ever comes from Viktor Frankl. He's a Holocaust survivor and author of Man's Search for Meaning. And his quote is, everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. I mean, you talk about powerful. If a Holocaust survivor who lost his entire family and endured hardships we could never imagine can keep a great attitude and talk to us about the importance of attitude, I'm absolutely certain that I can work on that. Thirdly, I think being a great teammate. If you're just because you know you're a leader and manager, I think you still have an important part on the team. And I'll tell you, I was deployed to Iraq. We'd have a monthly large maintenance meeting with all the aviation units on the base, and they'd explain the status of their aircraft and talk about their issues. And one unit had an aircraft that was down for several days because they needed an engine. They didn't have an engine. My boss turns to me and says, hey, don't we have an engine in the hangar? And I knew we did, but it was the only one we had. And I knew we were just as busy as everybody else's. He said, hey, I don't care. Give it to them. They need it, and we can help. And that was an incredible lesson in teamwork and being a good teammate. And then finally, pick up trash. Every night, my brigade commander and I would walk together to the dining facility while we were deployed in Iraq. I was the XO, the second command of the brigade, and the brigade commander. On one of those first walks, I watched as he bent down and picked up a piece of trash, and he carried it with him to the dining facility and threw it in the trash can. He looked at me and said, I don't understand how people can walk past that and not pick it up. His lesson of not accepting substandard conditions or performance stuck with me. You know, great managers don't accept things that aren't right in their organization, and they work to fix them and make it better for everybody.
I love it, man. You do a great job of storytelling, brother. You use this idea of picking up trash and parlay it into this idea of there's just certain, I'm hearing set the standard, uphold the standard. Don't allow mediocrity. I'm hearing a hint of hold people accountable. And that kind of tenet, that habit that you're sharing of these four high-performing managers. The third one that I heard from is be a great teammate. The second one is, again, Dave's call out and his embrace of having a positive attitude. And then finally, just be good with people. And people, you know, may be thinking, well, how do I be good with people? You know, what tactically can I do to be good with people? And I would just offer up these four things. Exercise humility, right? If you can just embrace this idea of no matter, I'm the manager, I'm in charge, but I don't know everything. It's really difficult when you take the approach, I'm the manager, I'm in charge, and I know everything. Right? That's a recipe for disaster, in my opinion. To this point, for your son, who's about to step into, being a manager at 21 years old. We both know this day. We both did it. You're responsible for a group of 30 people. Your first time managing, maybe. You know, if you can just step into that and tell your second in command, in my case, it was the platoon sergeant, hey, Jeff, here's what I feel like I can do to serve this organization, but here's where I need a lot of help from you, man. Right? So humility is really powerful. Be empathetic, be fair, right? I think those are ways in which you're good with people and people see it. And then absolutely, as a manager, you have the burden of setting expectations, which in my work as a coach, a leadership coach, people, managers specifically really struggle with this, y'all. So if you're managing right now and you've not done a good job of setting expectation for the people that you're serving, you're doing them a disservice. And to that end, if you have a manager and they haven't set expectations for you, I'm talking goals, y'all, right? You better get in that office and ask them what they are and why. Because I think those are things, you know, when Dave talks about be good with people, that's what I'm hearing. I'm not saying that's what Dave's saying by any means, but that's what I'm hearing and wanted to share it out.
No, hey, Cord, those are great. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And your point about humility, so critically important. I couldn't have said it better. Fantastic ad.
Yeah. And especially in the Army's dynamic, when it's built this unique way that the officer's role is the person that's in command, the person in charge, the manager, but probably has the least amount of experience within the team from a hard tactical skill set place, right? Clearly, Dave, when you're a colonel in the Army and you're the commander, you're in charge, I'm not going to argue you have the least amount of experience. Again, maybe in the technical place that you're leading, but there's tremendous experience in that moment. Humility, it just never gets old, y'all, right? And that's why I'm wearing it out here, no matter what you're doing and what level you're serving in. I wanted to kind of return to, I think, an assumption I made earlier, Dave, about, certainly the job you're fired up with at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, but then the other way in which you're giving your time, which was as chief operating officer for the national nonprofit Wear Blue, Run to Remember. And my assumption was that you're involved here because it's filling up your cup, filling up your heart in some way that the professional workplace isn't delivering on. And so I'm just real curious, man, would you tell me why you're doing this work instead of me assuming it, right? And would you mind sharing the work of this organization with the listener? I had not heard about it until you showed it to me. And then maybe just share your role and how you're serving the organization.
I'll tell you, Cord, I'm super blessed, right? My professional needs are being met with my work at Merrill. And, that learning and leader development, serving others, helping folks get better. So that is a blessing. You know, I recognize that I was very fortunate to get a position where it meets my personal why, and I'm very happy with the organization. But my work with Wear Blue addresses an addition, you know, another area of something that's critically important to me, and that's our military and their families. So I'll tell you super quick, in 2012, I was finishing up a year-long deployment to Afghanistan. We were stationed in Kandahar, and for everybody who's been deployed, they'll recognize the Stars and Stripes military newspaper that's delivered to the bases in the military overseas. One morning, the headline on that newspaper said, "Afghanistan, the Forgotten War." And I tell you, that really just bothered me. It bothered me because almost nightly, we would go to the airfield where they would conduct a ramp ceremony. And the ramp ceremony is where units would bring their fallen service members and place them on aircraft for their final flight home. And these ceremonies were typically done in the middle of the night because of the scheduling of the aircraft back to the United States. And they had hundreds and hundreds of service members from across the entire base stand in formation on both sides of the aircraft as the unit escorted their fallen service members on board the aircraft. We did that almost nightly. And as I stood there in the dark, and I waited for the unit to arrive, and then when they arrived and they announced the service member's name and his age and where he was from and the unit that he was in, I couldn't help but think that, hey, this was such a young person. I mean, typically they were very young in their late teens, early 20s.
Yeah.
And I thought about their families back home who had received word that their loved one had been killed, and now where they're just simply waiting for them to arrive in the United States. So that headline, Afghanistan, the Forgotten War. Had we truly forgotten that we have men and women dying here in Afghanistan in service to our nation? Very troubling. So I got back to Fort Bragg a few months later, and a friend of mine contacts me and says, hey, I want you to hear about this organization, Wear Blue, Run to Remember. They're a national running organization that honors the service and sacrifice of the American military by focusing on three distinct pillars: empowering the families of the fallen, supporting the men and women still in uniform, and honoring and remembering those who have died in service to our country. It's an active organization. The founder, Lisa Hallett, says, I don't want to sit in a sense of static remembrance. I want to do something active to honor my husband, and therefore running it did it for her. So the organization, it hosts tribute miles at major races across the country, including the Marine Corps Marathon, where they'll line a portion of the race course with images of fallen service members. And then after the images, they line, they have volunteers holding American flags with a streamer adorned with a fallen service member's name on it. And Court, I'll tell you that Marine Corps Marathon, the first year there was a couple posters and a couple flags. This past year, we had over 250 posters and 250 volunteers holding flags. And it is recognized as the most impactful part of the Marine Corps Marathon. It's an incredible experience. And then we also have a Gold Star race program, a Gold Star youth mentorship program, and an active duty service race program. Hey, if I can, just a second, I really want to explain what's so powerful about this organization. The Gold Star race program takes a Gold Star family members, and for whatever reason, for the most part, they've been women, moms and spouses of fallen service members. We take them and we give them the opportunity to participate in either a half or a full marathon at the Marine Corps Marathon or the half marathon in Seattle or Chicago. So we take these folks who say, I will never be able to get through the grief of losing my husband or spouse or loved one. And that's absolutely true. They will never get over that. I mean, that will be something they endure for the rest of their lives. But how many times have you heard somebody say, I could never run a marathon or a half marathon?
Often. And I say it all the time.
So we give them that opportunity, and we give them a training plan with a certified coach. We give them running gear. We give them the support of a community. And Court, let me tell you about the power of watching one of these folks step off at the Marine Corps Marathon, and at mile 26.2, when they cross the finish line and a young Marine in uniform puts that medal around their neck and salutes them and says, congratulations, you're a marathoner. That is life-changing. And it shows them that they can indeed get through challenging, difficult, hard things because they've done it. They've run a marathon. So it's an incredible organization. We don't give anybody anything. We actually ask of them. We ask them to be active. We ask them to actively honor the fallen. We ask you to get out and run in honor or walk in honor of a fallen service member or those still serving or their family members. The organization was founded by Lisa Howlett after she lost her husband, Captain John Howlett, in Afghanistan in 2009. And this year we celebrated our 10th year as an organization, and we've honored literally thousands and thousands of fallen service members.
Wow. I did see the YouTube video you sent me about Lisa, her two kids, one of which has got the same first name as my son, Bryce, and her daughter, which, by the way, y'all, I mean, her husband never saw their daughter, correct?
That's correct. Absolutely true.
Yeah, because he passed at the war, and the little girl was born while he was deployed. So it's a phenomenal, moving story. Tip my hat to the work that she's done and continues to do for others, given her own life experience. Hey, Dave, where can someone learn more about this organization?
Yeah, thanks, Cord. It's www.wearblueruntoremember.org. Excuse me.
.org. So pretty easy to find. Wearblueruntoremember.org. So, hey, I know everyone's challenged right now. We're laying this episode down in the end of July 2020. And there's a national pandemic that's still alive and kicking, and a lot of folks out of work, but there's not a greater cause to give to if you can find yourself making a donation or helping these folks continue to serve families. Folks that have lost someone in the war that is not forgotten. Could be Afghanistan, could be Iraq, could be other places around this great country. Anything else, Dave, you want to share about your work there and what they're involved with?
No, I think that covers it, Court. Thanks for the shout out. And, you know, it all it requires is you, right? So you can get out, you walk out your back door, go for a walk in your neighborhood or a run in your neighborhood it's as simple as that. Or you can join in on our local Saturday runs and a run near you, or participate in one of our bigger programs.
Cool. And so I'm guessing maybe at that website, they give you an idea of where the chapters are present and where they're alive and where they're working. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely true.
Cool. Awesome. Another reason to get out and run, y'all. So thanks for sharing that with us. Couple other questions here, buddy. I know that you're coming up on time when we got to get you back into your day. But I do want to spend a moment getting some insight to you about what it takes to team with others. You've spent so much time in collaboration with other folks throughout your adult professional workplace and just life experience. And so I gotta believe that you have been on great teams that thrive. You certainly have rehabilitated teams that were underperforming. When you talk about what the Army asked you to do there in Wyoming with that recruiting company. So just curious, when you think about a team that's really hitting on all cylinders, Dave, the high performing teams, what does that collective unit need to do to achieve that, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think about the environment we're in today, right? I know personally, when I started work here in Jacksonville, Florida, my team is in Charlotte and Boston, so we're somewhat geographically dispersed even before this, the COVID environment. So now it's even more so the case. So it's vitally important to leverage, these things that help your team success, work successfully. I'd say first and foremost, it's important to leverage your talent, and I'll steal a portion of Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, but make sure when you're dealing with the performance issues, hey, have you really looked at that you've got your teammates in the right seat on the bus? Are they doing the job that they're best suited for, and both personally and professionally? And you need to leverage their strengths of the team and make sure their folks are where they can best support the mission and remain professionally happy. Secondly, and this really comes into play here in the virtual environment, but it's relevant, when we work close together, face to face as well. But I've found that teams that can that let that assume positive intent of their teammates, it seems to work much better for the organization. Assume positive intent. So when you're geographically dispersed, you're in a virtual environment, you're communicating via email, phone, text, and even Zoom or WebEx, all of that can be misconstrued. It's easy to misunderstand or not fully grasp what the other individual's saying. But if everybody goes into the team with the expectation that everyone is working for the greater good of the team, you're going to be off to a good start. And it creates the culture on the team that if you're not certain or you're unclear, or if it seems like somebody's not looking out for the greater good, you can address it, right? Because if I, hey, I just naturally assume, Court, you and I are going to work the, we're going to do very well for our teammates. And I do something contrary to that, the culture is there that you can approach me and discuss it. So, assuming positive intent in our communications and leveraging our talent, both to me, two important parts on effective teaming.
I really love this. I don't know that I've ever really heard a sharing out like this. And I've talked to tons of folks on this invitation to assume positive intent. I also think it's, in a way, an opportunity to just kind of be grateful and be optimistic, and probably ties in a little bit, Dave, in my opinion, to just the attitude that you should show up to and embrace of being positive. But I think it's something I'm absolutely gonna apply. And then, hey, I'm a benefactor of a manager that did this first habit when it applies to the collective team, which is leverage your talent. So much so that I was hired for a job to sell software. After 7 months and continued conversations with folks within the team I was a part of, people said, "Hey, Court, this isn't the right seat for you. And we're recognizing that you have talents in a different area. And we're going to move you out of the sales construct, and we're going to put you into the people and culture team. And we want you to be a leadership coach." And so these two resonate deeply with me on some of the teams that I've been a part of that really were performing at a high level. Leverage your talent and assume positive intent within your teammates. Thanks for sharing that, brother. I think really just two questions for you here, and then we can close things out. One is kind of, just reflective in nature, and that is, hey man, what do you miss most from the Army 2 years removed with the continued conversations with Shannon? Hey, I just retired, and her challenge to, no, Dave, it's been a couple of years, buddy. So I'm just curious what you might miss there. And then what's next for you, buddy?
Yeah, that's what do I miss most? It's absolutely without question the people. You know, I think back to my time and all the fantastic people that I've had the blessing to meet and serve with during my career. You know, Corey, you've been there in the 82nd, right? So after you jump out of a plane at night, and I was in an aviation unit, so we would jump out of the plane, we'd get all our gear together, and then we'd get on trucks and ride back to our unit. You probably walk back, you know, 15, 20 miles at a time with a big heavy pack on your back. But, you know, as an aviation organization, that wouldn't work for us. So
Yo,
hop,
why walk when you can fly? My close friend was
yeah.
a pilot.
So we would hop in the back, hop in trucks, and you know, I always enjoyed getting in the back of the truck with the soldiers and listen to their story. So it's pitch black in the middle of the night. We're heading back to our unit area, and I would just sit in the back quietly and listen to them talk about the stories of the jump, or their stories about, you know, what they're doing on the weekend or
Yeah.
whatever. And I just loved it because it was raw and it was real and genuine. On deployment as a battalion commander, the stress and challenges of being deployed and the responsibility, I found my greatest de-stressing time was I'd go and help unload the supply truck with a group of soldiers.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just so easy. I'd just stand there and help them unload the truck. And I'd listen to their stories and talk about their deployment, their plans for when they were going on R&R leave or when they got home. And you know, it was just so great. You know, so often we hear stories or complaints about the younger generation. And I had to offer that, hey, those anybody who feels compelled to complain about where our youth and our country is, go spend some time with some service members. They're selfless, they're incredible, they're driven, just fantastic young men and women that are representative of our country as a whole. And I'm absolutely blessed to have served with them.
Absolutely, man. Agree. What are you going to do
Hey,
next,
and
brother?
yeah, so next, great question. You know, it's funny, is you think about in the military, you know, you get used to moving every 2 or 3 years. And, you know, so here I am you know, I've been with the firm now for just over a year, and I'm thinking, okay, when am I getting orders? Where are we going next? And that may not be the case, right? I may end up living in Jacksonville for a while. But professionally, I am looking for formal education opportunities or training opportunities to increase my knowledge and experience in leader development. I'd really like to get, you know, pursue some kind of certifications or licensure opportunity so I can be better at work and home. Once the COVID pandemic clears up, I'd love to, you know, spend some time traveling to see my kids in their college environments. We got one more year with our son up at West Point. We got another year, potentially a little bit longer with my daughter in Colorado. I want to go see them in their environment. And then really enjoy this time of life with my wife. You know, we'll celebrate our 25th anniversary in September. She, you know, the family members serve with alongside their service members and oftentimes carry the even heavier load. And she's absolutely deserving of a great celebration for our anniversary and my time now that I'm out.
No doubt. What's Ryan, your senior there at West Point, considering from a branch perspective, or does he already have one?
They'll find out this coming fall, and his first choice is aviation.
There you go. Dad, being that effective, positive influence on his life. He must have told some great stories, man, or I guarantee he's looking back and saying, you know what, Dad? Man, you created a great life for me. I'm thankful, so much so that I want to be like Dad. And I gotta believe, man, that makes you feel good. Might not be the intent that you set out for as a father, but I think, you know, as I'm a young father now of a 9 and 11 year old, don't know I want my daughter to go into the service, to be totally honest. But if my son says, hey, Dad, I want to go in the Army, I want to be a special forces guy, you know. Maybe I had some sort of an impact on that, and I'd be super damn proud of them, as I am sure you are of your kids. So, hey, brother, thanks for sharing that with us. Thank you for your reflections here and just going through some of your experience, what you've learned about managing, what you've learned about high-performing teams, and really just some perspective on how you've done that so well throughout your adult life. I think that's a wrap, though, brother. Is there anything else in this moment you feel moved to share before we close out together?
Just thanks, Court. You know, again, I really appreciate it. I'm humbled by the opportunity to be on the conversation today. I'll tell you that, you know, leadership to me is, if I, just like a recruiter, if I want to be a good recruiter, I got to be a good soldier. If I want to be a good leader, I got to be a good person. And by being a good leader and a good person, then I'm a better father, I'm a better spouse, I'm a better coach, I'm a better business person. It transcends my entire life. And your work here is important and it's impactful, and I appreciate being part of it.
Yeah, man, I'm thankful for you. So thrilled to have you part of my network and to be here together on the show. So I can't wait to get it out there for the world to see and hear about. Want to close out, brother, in the way that we always do, which is your opportunity to kind of just give your own unique rubber stamp on the episode by leading us through the high performance breakdown. I know you've heard it before, but it's real simple. I'm going to speak the words breakdown on three. When you hear the word three, that's your invite to give us three claps. And then just speak the words, because you're going to make me smile. Boom, shakalaka. And then we'll close out this show together. Does that work?
It works.
All right, brother. So breaking us out here in High Performance Pathways, my close friend, former soldier, retired Army aviator, father, husband, VP of Learning and Leader Development there for Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. And who knows what's next for this great American. Break down, brother, on three. One, two, three.
Boom shakalaka.
Love it. Boom shakalaka. Checking in from Florida to North Carolina to wherever you are listening to this show today. Thanks for being with us. Hopefully you've got something here that inspired you in some way to continue to chase high performance in your life. Hey, to connect with Dave, which I encourage you to do, a lot of resource, insight, and really conversation that I know he'd be happy to share with others because he's a given guy. Find him on LinkedIn at Dave Leach. Leach is spelled L-E-A-C-H. Look for an incredible amount of service, 32 years. And look for that VP of Learning and Leader Development as part of his handle there on LinkedIn. You got the right guy. Hey, get out there, everybody. Allow Dave's comments to inspire you in your professional life and chase high performance. We'll talk next week. Bye.